Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Come to you on WILL AM 580, beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have a terrific show for you. Joining us on the phone lines will be the author of an extraordinary new book, Consumed: How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole. The author, Benjamin R. Barber, will be our guest today right here on Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
For 7.5 months, independent journalist Josh Wolf languished in a federal prison in California for refusing to testify in front of a grand jury investigating the actions of people involved in a 2005 San Francisco protest against an international economic summit. Wolf attended the protest and videotaped the actions of some of its participants and later published excerpts from the tape on his blog. Although the state of California has a shield law that protects journalists from being coerced into becoming informants for the government, federal prosecutors took Wolf's case, which left him unprotected. However, earlier this month, Wolf walked out of prison a free man after becoming the longest imprisoned journalist in U.S. history. He's been freed from testifying in front of the grand jury, though he did turn over his unedited tape of the protest to prosecutors while simultaneously releasing it to the public online. Wolf says he doesn't feel like he wasted his time in prison, especially since he walked out with his ethics intact.
Either you're an investigative person for the public, or you're an investigator for law enforcement. And if you're an investigator for law enforcement, the public has no reason, or they're just not going to trust you. And if the public doesn't trust the press, then the press can't get their stories out. And as a result, in the end, the public suffers.
Throughout his ordeal, the courts have debated whether or not Josh Wolf was a real journalist, since he volunteered to cover the protest. But Wolf says that shouldn't matter.
A journalist's mission is to provide the truth to the public. I came out to the protest in order to document it and provide the truth to the public. That is the role of a journalist. Now, whether I'm motivated by a professional means, by an economic means, or whether I'm motivated simply by the pursuit of the truth is no difference.
Wolf's tape doesn't appear to provide any real evidence to federal prosecutors seeking to punish participants in the 2005 protest, during which a police officer was injured and a squad car damaged. He's still not quite sure why the state placed so much importance on him and his coverage of the event. The only thing he can think of is that they were on a witch hunt to punish civil dissidents.
What would happen were I to testify is they'd go through the video and go, "Do you know that person? Do you know that person?" as new people showed up on the film. Anyone that I said I knew, they'd probably ask me, how can I contact them? Then those people would be called in, forced to watch the tape, and identify everyone they knew.
Having been honored by professional journalist organizations for defending their rights to freely cover the world at the cost of his own freedom, Josh Wolf says he'd do it all over again if he had to. And he plans to spend time lobbying for federal laws to strengthen the autonomy of the American press.
I anticipate that I'll probably be in Washington before long, trying to meet with congresspeople and pushing forward with a robust, comprehensive federal shield law, which protects bloggers and other independent journalists.
Learn more about Josh Wolf and his work by visiting his website, www.joshwolf.net.
The voracious merger appetite of the new AT&T has been good for its chief executive officer, Ed Whitaker, who infamously declared in the business press that he would leverage control of half the broadband pipes in America to extract more money from the online world, personally made about $32 million in the last year. This includes a salary of nearly $9 million, $22 million in AT&T stock awards, and various perks, such as a corporate jet. Between 2000 and 2005, Whitaker pulled down more than $85 million in executive compensation, while the return AT&T shareholders saw from their stock fell by almost half. Whitaker's contract with AT&T expires next April. Whenever he retires, he's guaranteed a $19 million bonus, pension of at least $5 million a year, health insurance for life, use of the corporate jet for up to 10 hours per month, and a free car.
The Federal Communications Commission has announced the opening of a long-awaited filing window for new non-commercial full-power FM radio stations. The FCC will take applications for new stations from October 12th through the 19th. This could be one of the last opportunities we'll ever see to expand and strengthen community radio in America. You can learn more about the potential to build a new station where you live by going online and visiting getradio.org. The FCC's also announced the fourth of its six promised public hearings on media ownership. It'll take place on April 30th in Tampa, Florida. The exact time and location have yet to be announced. Check www.stopbigmedia.com for further details. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Host Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, April 15th, just before tax day 2007, on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. It's my pleasure to be with you today. Today we have a tremendous show for you, so I've been looking forward to. Our guest joining us on the telephone is Benjamin Barber, professor at the University of Maryland, the fellow at Demos in New York City, and the author of many books, Jihad versus McWorld perhaps being the most famous until now, and currently the author of the brand new book, Consumed, How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole, just published this year by W.W. Norton. It's my pleasure to welcome to Media Matters Ben Barber. Professor Barber?
Good to be with you today.
Well, I must tell you, I've spent the last few days reading your book. It's a pleasurable read. It's really a page-turner, and it's a provocative book, one of the most provocative books I've read in quite some time.
Well, I'm delighted. Thank you very much. I have a great admiration for all that you've done, and I'm delighted that you were able to read it and to talk to you today.
Yeah, well, you know, I think the core thesis of your book, or one of the core arguments you're making, is about the relationship of capitalism to democracy. And I think in the conventional wisdom of the past decade or two in the United States, and certainly in our sort of official political culture, both Republican and Democrat, capitalism and democracy are, if not synonymous, seen as extraordinarily complementary and not antagonistic in any way. Your book, I think, really says that's not actually an accurate reading of what's going on today. Can you explain?
Well, that's right. And let me just, as background, as social scientists, remind all of us that in any case, democracy is a political system and a system of society, and capitalism is an economic system. And the result is that they are two different systems, and there are various ways in which they hook up. And we know historically that places like communist China have been successfully capitalist, fascist Chile successfully capitalist, and we know that democracies in Scandinavia have been social democratic. So there's no necessary relationship. And you're right, Bob, in recent decades, including in the Clinton administration, people talked about market democracy or democratic capitalism as if they were the same thing. Now, for me, it's very important to understand the distinction, and it's particularly easy, perhaps, to see that distinction when we think not so much about political and social and economic systems as about identities. Because if we think of ourselves on the one hand as consumers and producers in an economic zone, which we are, but on the other hand also as citizens, members of a neighborhood, a community, a civil society, and a democratic government, on the other hand, we can see that in the distinction between what it is to be a producer and a consumer and to be a citizen, there's a very wide gap. And the argument of this book is that the emphasis today on 24-hour consumerism, hyper-consumerism, consumerism 24-7 is actually eroding our sense of civic identity and displacing our sense of citizenship in ways that are bad for democracy.
Is this a process that has been going on steadily for a long period of time, or is it a process that has picked up momentum and steam considerably in recent years?
I think it has picked up an awful lot of steam, and it also suggests something about the development of capitalism, because capitalism in the 15th and 16th century in Europe, as it was first invented, and later in the 18th and 19th century in the United States, where it took wing, was a system which had a quite remarkable recipe. it suggested that if you produce goods and services that respond to real human needs and wants, you can both create wealth, create a more prosperous society, and at the same time make a profit for yourself. So it kind of linked together self-interest and altruism in a healthy kind of way. It put self-interest at the service of altruism and put altruism at the service of self-interest. And it worked that way for a long time. That was the basis for the wonderful marriage between Puritanism and capitalism in early America, where the virtues of saving and hard work and deferred gratification and service to others in Protestantism reinforced the very virtues that were needed for early capitalism, where you were trying to accumulate wealth, defer taking profits, invest in real needs, and serve the whole society as well as yourself. And what's changed really in the last 50 or 75 years is that because capitalism succeeded in the developed world so well in meeting real human needs and wants, to some degree, we might say that if you're a member of the middle class, at least, in a developed part of the world, most normal needs and wants have been met by the capitalist economy, which means that capitalism, to keep selling all the goods it produces, has to not just manufacture goods to meet our needs, but has to get in the business of manufacturing needs to sell all the goods it has. And that, of course, leads to marketing and advertising and targeting children and dumbing down adults and all of the kind of pathologies that I associate with recent capitalism. So to sum it up, the success of capitalism in meeting our elemental needs and wants has, in a sense, put us into an era of phone needs and wants and resulted in a capitalism that's kind of runaway consumerism, hyper-consumerist, and now, in a sense, backfiring and neither serving the real needs of people nor even serving the need of capitalism to survive.
I want to go through this argument slowly and let you develop it, because I don't think a thumbnail does any justice to the richness or complexity of what you present in your book, Professor Barber. But before we go through it slowly, let's just jump to the end, or at least to the middle, and explain why this rise of advertising, marketing, hyper-commercialism, what is the problem with that for democracy? And why should we be concerned at that level?
Well, and that's also, and I appreciate you're saying it's hard sometimes to talk about, you know, the kinds of things you talk about in a 300 or 400-page book in thumbnail, and we have the privilege of, you know, having a considerable amount of radio time, but, you know, to talk about this in 5 or 10 minutes is not easy. But the problem for democracy is that when the private logic of consumers and producers displaces the public logic of citizenship, we actually begin to distort our public environments in ways we don't intend. Private choices have public consequences. When we think that private liberty is all there is, the liberty of choosing between brands, the liberty of making consumer choices is all the liberty there is, we end up with inadvertent consequences in the social realm that we no longer control. And let me just give you a couple of quick examples of that, because the examples here are, I think, helpful. One is Walmart. I mean, I don't want to get into the stuff about unions and so on. That's a whole separate issue. Walmart is a good thing for consumers with respect to the diversity and pluralism of goods and the cheapness with which they are offered. So that as a consumer, we can all applaud Walmart, putting aside their social labor practices and so forth, which maybe they're beginning to do something about. But putting that aside, it's good for consumers. But in fact, the inadvertent social consequences of Walmart and other big box mall stores is the destruction of our retail communities in cities and towns and villages across America. In other words, in making the consumer choice to have more goods at cheaper prices, we inadvertently destroy our downtowns, watch the rot of towns and villages across America, encourage a kind of brown earth suburban growth that nobody really approves of. We, in other words, end up with social consequences we didn't intend as a result of private choices. We also ignore the social costs that are built in. If you priced Walmart's goods not just according to what Walmart was charging, but the social cost to America of the destruction of our towns and villages and mom-and-pop stores and small retail stores, their prices would be so high that they couldn't compete with mom-and-pop stores. So the real issue for democracy is that when you displace the public logic of social choice, public choice, and civic choice that we make as citizens with private consumer choices, and think that that's the same thing, you end up with a horrendous impact on the social environment.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Benjamin R. Barber, author of the brand new book, Consumed, How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole, just published by W.W. Norton. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Professor Barber, the number here at Media Matters on WILL AM 580 is 333-9455, or the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Professor Barber, in the book, one of the most provocative theses you have, or one of the arguments you make that I think is most striking, concerns your argument that what we have, and it's in your subtitle, the nature of our culture is infantilizing adults and corrupting children, but especially the notion of infantilizing adults that I think is so intriguing. Can you explain a little bit what you mean by that and what the problem is with that?
Well, yes, and again, it follows from the original logic of modern consumer capitalism. If capitalism needs people to consume goods they don't really want or need, then it's got to, in effect, manufacture needs, create needs, and it's got to create 24-hour consumers. And to do that, the last thing in the world it wants is prudent adults who, after all, like the rest of us, are people who like to pray and play and make love and make art and do recreation and do an awful lot of things that have nothing to do with shopping and consuming. But the trouble is, capitalism needs us to consume because it's overproducing all these goods and gadgets and so forth. And the result is, in order to assure the levels of consumption it needs, it begins, first of all, to dumb down adults, which is to say, turn them not leave them as prudent, thoughtful consumers, but turn them into the kind of imprudent, acquisitive, impulsive teenagers that will buy the kind of junk that's being made for teenagers. And at the same time, they need to target children and enlarge the consumer background by getting kids to get control of the discretionary income of their parents and become buyers. They talk about liberating children from the gatekeepers who are their parents and empowering them, again, a word marketers use, to spend their parents' income. But what I'm suggesting is that all of this is not about mischief or about evil doing. It's about capitalism trying to sell all these goods and needing to do it in this fashion. So part of what I'm trying to do is not simply do a journalistic commentary on all the commercialism and hyper-consumerism, which is as plain as the day before our eyes, but to explain what it is and to suggest it's much more dangerous than we might think because it's part of the logic of capitalism itself, not a kind of accidental, incidental feature of commerce that we can easily overcome.
We'll talk a little bit more. Give some examples of what you mean when you talk about the infantilization of the
public. Well, sure. Let's give a couple examples, kind of stunning ones, actually. I mean, one is I did a number of searches to try to figure out what's popular in America and the world. And I'll give you two examples. I looked at the top Google queries. Google keeps an account of questions that are asked on Google in the United States, and in 2004, you can do this for any year. When I was doing my research, it was 2005, so I was looking back at 2004. The top four Google queries in the year 2004, among all populations, all demographics, old people, young people, kids, and so on, were Britney Spears, Paris Hilton, Christina Aguilera, and Pamela Anderson. Now, that is, in fact, a profile you would expect from the top Google queries from 15-year-old teenage girls. But this is not what it is. These are the top Google queries across the board for everybody. Same thing you see with top-grossing films, not just in America, but around the world. Same year, 2004, and this is replicated every year, top-grossing films worldwide among all populations, all tickets sold, adults, old people, young people, teens, and so on. Shrek 2, Spider-Man 2, the Harry Potter film of that year, and The Incredibles. Four nice films made for teenagers that, in fact, dominated global markets in almost every country in the world. For that to happen, adults have to acquire the tastes of teenagers, and marketers and advertisers work hard for that to happen. The New York Times had a piece just a couple weeks ago whose headline was, "Pirates, Penguins, and Potboilers Rule Box Office." Now, what they didn't say was teenagers rule box office, but that's the truth. And, of course, teenagers don't really rule the box office. It's adults turn into teenagers who rule the box office.
You know, when I read your book, Professor Barber, I was struck in a more, I mean, at the cultural criticism you provided of this whole idea of adults acting like kids. And just example after example, it was really quite striking. I mean, even beyond the Google searches, but just, you know, the idea that, you know, grown adults are sort of just trying to act like they did when they were 14 years old.
Well, there are so many examples. You know, we see corporate executives in their 40s and 50s, the whole 90s movement of the new technology companies and so on, where they dress in T-shirts and their shirts are out and they wear baseball caps and so on. The informality of kids. Fast food, which is designed for people who don't want to sit down when they eat, that's children namely, now is the, you know, most popular food worldwide. Botox, you know, older people trying to freeze their faces with a poison to make them seem young. Even these places where old people live without children, you think, well, that goes in the opposite direction. There are a lot of communities that don't permit children, but that's because the old people are the children. I mean, that's say they want to be the center of attention. They want all the services of the neighborhood where they live to be geared to them. They want to stay kids, and of course, the first thing that turns into an adult in our society is to have kids when you realize there's somebody else with real needs that you've got to take care of. So there's this odd thing where we become kids, but we try to push kids out of our lives so that we can actually go on being the children. And as you say, the evidence, there's evidence everywhere in the media, even the latest IMUS thing. I mean, I think the missing element in the analysis there was that what this is about is not just scatology and racism and bigotry. It's about puerility. It's about childishness. I mean, this is the kind of talk. I mean, talk radio is the talk of 14-year-olds. Kids who don't think before they speak, who are bigoted and dogmatic and don't really have any sense of nuance. The polarization politically is a sign of the dumbing down. I mean, the IMUS culture, which is the Howard Stern culture, which is the Comedy Central culture, which is the culture and the Rush Limbaugh culture, is all a culture basically of kids. And I don't mean to insult kids, because in fact a lot of kids are a lot smarter than that, but it's a culture of impulse, of not thinking before you speaking, of silly meanness and insulting people just for the hell of it. I actually think it's less bigoted. I think it's less about bigotry than it is just about stupidity and juvenilia.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Benjamin Barber, author of the brand new book, Consumed, How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. In the coming weeks, our guests on Media Matters will include Davey D., Laura Flanders, Barbara Ehrenreich, Jeremy Scahill, Dave Zirin, Tim Robbins. So please keep joining us every week for an original live show, a call-in show that you can participate in. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Professor Barber, the number here at WILL AM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, which is open at this point, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Ben Barber.
Hi. I can't wait to buy your book. I think this sounds like a really good book. But I just had a couple comments that I hope you could just elaborate on. But a couple things that come to mind when I hear you talking is the idea of economic growth and how we have an idea in our society that this is always good, and it seems like we equate being able to purchase things with freedom. And it seems like economic growth without any kind of regulation. It's like politicians now seem like they will never argue against economic growth. And I hope you could comment on that. And the other comment that I had was, it seems like anytime you talk about like raising taxes on businesses, they'll always come back with, well, it'll just raise prices for consumers. So it really seems to manipulate the political system. So I hope those questions make, or the comments make sense, and you can elaborate them on them. Thank you.
Thank you, caller. Professor Barber?
Well, thanks. Those are great comments, and they, in a sense, stand for themselves. But let me just elaborate, because I agree with you completely on both. On the economic growth question, there are two points. One is, as you rightly imply, economic growth is only one sort of value in our society. In a pluralistic society, it's important. Every society needs a decent material foundation of goods and services to build on. But to think that economic growth is all there is, of course, to actually misjudge who we are as human beings, because all of us know that the material foundations of our life are only one important but by no means a total part of what we do. And one of my critiques of the kind of focus on consumerism and production and so on is that it distorts the pluralism of our lives and kind of totalizes the consumer economy and makes it all that there is. You know, and look at all the signage we face. Imagine a world in which on every sign that has Coke or Nike or any other commercial logo, instead there was a slogan that said "Praise Allah" or "Praise Jesus" or "Praise Yahweh." You know, we'd say, "Oh my God, that's a theocracy." You know, we can't do that. Or imagine that there was a political slogan, you know, "Kill the running dogs of capitalism, support the Communist Party." We'd say that's a totalitarian society, rightly. But when we are surrounded everywhere on television, in the movies, on the internet, all around us in physical space, with signage that advertises commercial goods, then we say that's freedom, that's about economic growth. So there's a lot more than that. The second implication of what you say, of course, is that to control and balance economic growth with other values, we have to act as citizens. And that's why the privatization of the last 30 years, from the time that Reagan said the problem is government, the solution is markets, and to some degree the Clinton administration bought into that as well. Democrats and Republicans alike, new Democrats and old Republicans alike, agree that the market can solve all. We've destroyed the partnership between capitalism and democracy, under which capitalism has always been most fair and most effective. And we have to recreate that partnership. Finally, about your point about taxes, people complain about taxes, but that's why I talked about the invisible social costs of the private consumer prices that we pay. I mean, the fact is we're paying a much larger price for those cheap Walmart goods than we think. Not only are we paying for non-union labor and so on, but we are also paying, as it were, for the destruction of our downtown areas and our classical retail and the mom-and-pop stores with the backbone of our civic culture. We're destroying all of those. There's no price tag on them. That's invisible. So the tax thing, you know, the trouble with these people who talk about privatization is they see taxes as the cost of public things, but they don't, in fact, put into their private prices all of the social costs that the goods they're selling us privately are going to cost us. So I think both of your points are really strong and important.
Professor Barber, you mentioned that new Democrats as well as old Republicans were part of the privatization, pro-commercialization movement, which has accentuated and exaggerated and created the mess that we're in of hyper-commercialism. And you also suggest in the book this requires a political solution. This is going to be solved through the market. It'll take citizens coming together. Do you see signs of light on the horizon politically that there are people organizing to try to change things to the better, to reassert democratic values?
I do see that. I think we see in the pendulum, you know, there always is a political pendulum, and, you know, it may even be that back in the 60s and in Europe from the 30s to the 60s, there was such an emphasis on the social welfare state and the state solving everything, what conservatives call the nanny state, that we began to forget about the role of entrepreneurship and individualism in the market. But what's happened in the last 30 years is the pendulum has swung so far in the other direction, the notion that markets solve everything, government does nothing, that we've actually disempowered ourselves. What taking away government really means is we take away our common power to solve problems. We literally disempower ourselves and are complicit in it. And I see an awful lot of people beginning to realize that, in fact, we need government. I mean, the first realization perhaps came in New Orleans when the president tried to suggest that this is really the private sector and the state and local sector that had to deal with it, whereas a lot of Americans realized that a crisis of this magnitude required that we solve some of the problems there, that we rebuild a city, that we deal with global warming publicly through our common institutions. Even the war in Iraq, whether you support it or don't, most Americans don't, imagine that we'd say simply, well, anyone who cares about that should pick up a rifle and go over and fight. We would never think of privatizing that function, although we've actually turned over some military functions to private security firms. But we understand that national security, ecology, are things that require that we work together. Well, it turns out there are a lot of other things like that that include education and transportation and environment and rebuilding cities and social justice and regulating the capitalist economy, not just so that it's fair and just, but that so it's competitive and entrepreneurial and actually works. Because the other thing about capitalism today is not just that it's undermining democracy, but it's not working very well.
Our guest, Benjamin Barber, author of the brand new book, Consumed: How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Ben Barber.
Hello. Without really commenting on the premise, I wanted to share just from today's news quote, a little example of the infantilization. There was a little piece on a program that plays here right before the McChesney show. It's on the media. It purports to review the media. And there was a story about global warming, and kind of the story was how the carbon emitters were changing their image to be more friendly, and rather than saying it's not happening, they're saying, well, it's a good thing. But the balance to that story was a communications professor who was talking about the reason that this is not succeeding, at least with conservatives, is because scientists are failing to make it more appealing. And I just found that to be a really extraordinary way to present the story, that global warming isn't catching on because we're not making it fun enough, you know. And I just thought that might be an example of what you were talking about.
That's a great point.
That's
and,
all.
And very ironic.
Barbara,
and very funny.
Let me add on to that, because that is a very good point, because one of the really interesting chapters in the book, you go through some of the critique that was, I think, first brought to my attention by Neil Postman 3 decades ago and developed over the years about the sort of tendencies in media, culture, and education. And I think you encapsulate them in sort of 3 catch-all explanations of what's taking place with this infantilization. One is easy over hard. The second is simple over complex. The third is fast over slow. That these are the dominant cultural trends of infantilization. And that seems to explain what's going on here, too, doesn't it?
It sure does, and it actually works very well when you apply it to the media, because, again, I've been bothered by the IMUS discussion, because it's been a discussion either about IMUS crossing a line or about bigotry or not, and is America still racist, is IMUS a racist, when, as I say, to me, it's all about talk radio's inherent juvenilia and its appeal to kiddie taste. It is about fast. You know, there's never time to talk. It's always sound bites and so on. It's about easy, and God forbid you say things are difficult. And it's particularly about simplifying things and not dealing with complexity. And the realities of the world we live in are very complex. And it's in the nature of dogmatic talk radio, whether on the far left with certain people at Air America, or much more typically, though, on the right with Ann Coulter or Hannity or Rush Limbaugh, that what makes me so mad about them is the way in which they simplify things. They leave the middle out. Nuance, ambiguity is not possible. Now, I would argue that the key feature of growing up is learning that the world is an ambiguous, difficult place where simple solutions don't work, where you've got to understand the complexity of life and of the world, where guys like Dick Cheney, who think it's all so simple about sexual orientation, end up with a gay daughter and suddenly realize things are a little more complicated and so on. But you never hear that on talk radio. You hear it on shows like this, and McChesney ought to take over from IMUS, maybe. That might be a solution to it. But, of course, it won't happen, because the whole point about IMUS and his ilk is that they were being paid to be shock jocks. And then we affect shock when they shock us. That's what they're being paid to do, because that's what 13-year-old scatology is all about, saying dirty words on the air, making sexual and racial references, precisely not because you're bigoted and so on, but just to shock people, because that's what talk radio is about, and that's what the big media firms that own the companies that own these radio stations are doing. If you really want to stop the buck about Amos, go back and fire the head of Viacom, fire the head of CBS, NBC, and all these other firms, because they're the ones who have been profiting from years and years and years by talking down to the American people and feeding them on cable television and talk radio this simplistic, dogmatic nonsense geared to stupid 13-year-olds, not to the many, many smart 13-year-olds there are around the country.
We've got a few callers waiting patiently, but I want to follow up on this before we go back to the phone lines, Professor Barber. Defenders of shock radio and of commercial culture writ large, and you respond to many of them in this book. I mean, much of the book is a response to the various arguments. We'll say that, well, these IMUS and commercial media are simply giving the people what they want. This is the reflection of people's actual taste. And you're just
right.
A pointy-headed intellectual who this is upset with the masses.
Exactly. No, and indeed, they go further. They say, you're supposed to be Mr. Strong Democracy. I wrote a book called Strong Democracy. You're supposed to care about democracy. The market is all about democracy. We just give people what they want. You know, you're an elitist. That's it. Now, you know, there are a couple things there. First of all, there are $230 billion a year spent on advertising, $40 billion of which is directed at kids. Now, I'd say if you're just giving people what they want, you don't need to be a quarter of $1 trillion a year in advertising. But much more important is to go back to what I call the civic schizophrenia we find in all of us. Of course, we all want all kinds of things. I want salt and sugar and fat, too, in my food. And I would love eating at McDonald's all the time, but I know it's not good for me. I know also as I develop a more mature palate, I will come to enjoy other things. And historically, society had institutions that helped us grow up, helped us become more complex, helped us want things that we want to want. There's a great philosophical distinction, and I think your audience is up to, you know, dealing with it, between first and second order wants. We want all sorts of things. You know, some of us want to, you know, rape and kill and have drugs and get fat and be lazy. But the question is, what do we want to want? As human beings, our second-order desires, the things that we want versus the things that we don't want to want, are what's the difference between us and an animal, between us and a drug addict. I mean, drug addicts know they want their drugs, but the ones who get over it know that they don't want to be drug addicts. They don't want to want drugs. And we live in a society where when people say, oh, we give people what they want, what they mean is they give people their first order, give me that, give me that. They don't address the second order, what do we want to want? What kind of a society do we want to live in? What kind of adults do we want to grow up into? And if they were doing that, they wouldn't possibly be giving us the kind of talk radio. They would go back to the 18th and 19th century when the media were seen as a fourth estate with civic responsibilities to help us be educated, to help us be citizens, and help us grow up. In other words, to help us do what we want to want rather than simply to pay attention to the first order, give me, I want this, I want that, I want the other thing.
Our guest today in Media Matters is Ben Barber, the author of the new book, Consumed, How Markets Corrupt Children and Vandalize Adults and Swallow Citizens Whole. We have a full bank of callers. I'm going to proceed and make sure we get all of you in and everyone else who calls in to the best of my ability. Let's go now to line three, Urbana. You're on the air with Benjamin Barber.
Hi. You just touched on one of the things I wanted to mention, and that was the fast foods. I think we're programmed to think that's a meal. Fries, cheeseburger, and a sundae. And I think that's one of our problems with obese teens, and heck, it still has an influence on me when I watch it. Another thing that I don't know if your book touches on is that when we see all these things advertised on TV, I think the youth may be especially susceptible, but adults are not exempt. And that is, we creates the want, but at the same time, we have the low-wage jobs, which I think in turn creates a lot of anger, and I submit crime, theft, the fast ways to make a buck, which might be selling drugs, so forth and so on. And you mentioned environment, and I'm glad you did, because, again, ramifications here are huge, and I know you don't have time to go into all of this, but I certainly will buy your book. Thanks.
Well, those are great, absolutely great points. And let me just give you one example to come back to Bob's, you know, thoughtful question about them saying, you know, they just give us what we want. Who in this country ever asked for bottled water for $2 a shot? We can get, we're lucky, we live in a nation with clean water, a good system that allows everybody to get, other than the public cost, which we forget about, but to get free water, clean water from our taps. Yet today, most Americans will buy at $2 a shot bottled boutique water, 80 or 90% of which is actually tap water that comes from Michigan or Texas and stuck in bottles and then sold to us. What earthly need is there for bottled water other than for the companies that do it to make a profit? And of course, on the other hand, on the other side of the world, there are 3 billion people without access to potable water who could do with entrepreneurs to help them solve their water problems. But here's capitalism selling us water there's no earthly need for, at the same time that there's a real need for clean water in another part of the world that capitalism has failed to address.
Before I go back to the next caller, I'd like to follow up on a point that this caller was just getting at. There's an important point in the book we haven't alluded to yet, which is the role of globalization, in particular the emerging economies in China and India, to this entire process. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, I mean, there are 2 things, as I just implied with what I said about bottled water. While capitalism in the developed world has succeeded in meeting an awful lot of our needs and therefore is involved in manufacturing phony needs for things we don't really need, around the world there are still a great many real needs that have not been met, and that capitalism, if we're willing to defer its gratification for immediate quarterly profits, might in fact help to address, helping to put capitalism back on a firm footing and helping undeveloped or underdeveloped societies create a wealth base and an entrepreneurial base for their own development. But as you say, all of these issues have to be seen in a global context of interdependence now, because of course capitalism can't simply operate in one country alone effectively. And in places like China and India, you see a kind of ambivalence about this whole thing, because on the one hand you see a rapidly developing consumer culture and new citizens, but you also see a productive capacity that far outstrips the consumer base there, so that they end up sending cheap products to the United States that further reinforce the consumer society here, at the same time that it drives the trade deficit in the wrong direction and ends up with Americans, in effect, turning over their treasury bills to the Chinese and others and consuming all their goods. So there are a lot of ramifications we can't talk about here that speak to the reality of a global market and to the worldwide selling to children, not just in the United States. And you can go to Russia and China today and go to marketing conferences on marketing to children in China, marketing to children in Russia.
Our guest, Ben Barber. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 4, Bloomington, Illinois. You're on the air with Ben Barber.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I think this has been a very good, healthy conversation today, and I'm definitely going to buy your book. What I want to touch on, because there's so many different factors and subjects we've been talked about in this short time, is that with capitalization, I'm a kid that grew up in Flint, Michigan, home of General Motors, and I look at General Motors now, you know, on a global market competing in the auto industry. And I really don't feel sad for them, even though I had parents that worked at General Motors, because of the simple fact is that General Motors could have made a better vehicle go 30 years ago, and now they're talking about, you know, the influx of Toyota and different foreign companies coming in here. But the truth of it is, and the science of it is, they could have made a vehicle that got 35, 40 miles a gallon 30 years ago. They had the technology. And so for some capitalization, I look at it is that, like you're saying, we're becoming a world of the haves and the have-nots, the easy, the complex. And I think some companies, you do have to penalize them, is that, yes, that might have been a complex 30 years ago, but you could have solved that problem, and now don't cry about it now. Just like with Walmart, you're talking about the mom-and-pop, you know, business is going out of business. The only thing I kind of see now in this day is that in the record industry with, you know, you used to have record stores. When you grew up, you always had a record store in your neighborhood. Those have dried up, because the competition from the box stores, from the Best Buys and Circuit Cities and even Targets that sell CDs now when they first come out for $8.99 and $9.99 versus you going into your mom-and-pop record stores, if they even exist, and they're probably still 15 and 16 because they can't order, you know, 2,000 with one title at one time. But I'd like for you to talk about maybe as far as that with the separation of have and have-nots, do we try to use the government again to maybe say, okay, then for the different tax dollars that you do use, can you fund it back to different entrepreneur organizations that's going to make microloans across the world? You know, it's one of those where the distribution of wealth has to be better, is that the people and the companies that are making great wealth should have some type of charitable arm to kind of give back to the organizations that don't have the funding but have the true purpose of saying, let's help others.
Well, we could spend the next month talking about all the good points.
Thank you, fella.
Thank you, caller.
Thank you. That's Bob. Those points were just so right on, and you know, a lot of them are sort of self-explanatory. Let me just say a quick thing about what the caller said, since his parents were up there in Flint and have suffered as a result of General Motors screwing up. Here's a capitalist corporation not acting in the spirit of old capitalism, taking some risks, deferring its own profits, and making goods that would be needed down the line, but instead deciding 15, 20 years ago, when they had, as the caller said, a technology, the hybrid technology, way out in front of the Japanese, and abandoned it in favor of making trucks and SUVs and these gas guzzlers, which was what they said people, quote, wanted at that moment, instead of looking at people at what people would need down the line. And, of course, what Toyota did is say, fine, you don't want the technology, we'll develop it. We're not going to get in the SUV business, but we are going to get in the hybrid business. We're going to worry about gas emissions and so on. And part of the reason that Toyota is about to surpass GM as the largest and most successful car manufacturer in the world, is that it made a true capitalist decision to take some risks, look at what it thought the market would need down the line, and end up making cars that are actually not just good for consumers, but are good for the rest of us as well, because at least they use a little less gas and they're looking at new alternative energy technologies. So that's the perfect example here. With respect to what you do, you know, about injustice and the haves and have-nots, part of what you do, obviously, is to develop global civic and political institutions that oversee global capitalism, because right now capitalism on the global market is anarchy. There are no global democratic institutions. But the other thing you've got to do is really direct capitalism towards the area where there are real needs. And that's why I'm a real fan of Muhammad Yunus, the Bangladeshi who just won the Nobel Prize for microcredit. And Bob, you just mentioned microcredit, or one of the callers perhaps just mentioned microcredit too, because what microcredit does is not just give philanthropy, give gifts to people in the third world, but it makes small investments, 50 or 100 bucks in a family or a mother, and says, here's a little dough, why don't you set up a small business doing something that your village needs, maybe fashioning clay filters from the clay at your feet to filter the water so you can get clean water. You'll deal with the water problem, you'll start a family business and jumpstart the economy, and you will be meeting real needs in your community. So I think what we need is not just a lot of global governance, but we need a partnership between democratic institutions and capitalism, in which capitalism goes back to answering real needs instead of creating faux needs in our world.
Before we get to the next caller, Ben Barber, I do want to bring up a couple points you raised in the book that I think I found very interesting. Thomas Friedman, you refer to on a few occasions in the book. Of course, he's written the book, The Earth is Flat, following in a lot of his columns in recent years, suggesting that the Internet and the new digital technologies are going to accomplish a lot of the positive things that you want to see accomplished on their own without necessarily requiring a great deal of public policy intervention, that they're going to spawn tremendous economic growth and raise living standards, that these technologies, if not magical, are certainly super powerful. And the second point I'd like you to refer to is there are some people who argue, and you talk about, I think, Steve Freeman in your book is one of them, that this sort of new culture that you are quite critical of is actually one that's making people a lot smarter, giving them skills we haven't recognized in the past, and is actually a quite benevolent process. So if you could just take on those two arguments as quickly as you can, and then we'll get back to
it. Yeah, I'll try to be real quick. And the second one, I mean, there are always, and actually Tom Friedman and Steve are, you know, in the same league because they're both busy celebrating and cheerleading, you know, all the stuff that's happening. And that's easy, of course, to say capitalism is wonderful, technology is wonderful, kids playing video games is great, they make good fighter pilots because they manipulate the same computer buttons in their jets and so forth. But if we see intelligence as dealing with complexity, dealing with ambiguity, synthesizing across many different fields, then clearly the new technologies don't do that. The other thing, of course, is that the new technologies tend always not to transform society, but to reflect the society we have. I wrote 20 years ago about the Internet as a potential place for civic discourse and for new forms of horizontal citizenship. But the reality is it's 99% commerce, pornography, game playing, and so on. In other words, it reflects what we're already doing. And to push it in another direction, we have to do that as citizens through regulation, through government experiments and public experiments and civic experiments. They don't just have to be the government, but we have to do that. It won't happen. The market's going to turn the Internet into an electronic mall and nothing more.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Let's go to line one, Bement. You're on the air with Ben Barber.
Yeah, hi. I was just thinking back to the way I thought when I was in junior high school, and it seems to me that just the theory of free market capitalism itself is incredibly infantile, with its sort of automatic, invisible hand, and you just set something in motion, and it will just happen, and it will be all good for all people. And, I mean, just that basis for a society would, I think, just create an infantile society.
I think that's right, and I think the point is capitalism works best when it's serving democracy and serving us. But in its recent incarnation, we have been servants of capitalism. Our children have been servants of selling things rather than and targeted by capitalism, and that's got it all wrong. Capitalism works best as an adult institution where it works under our supervision, under the supervision of adults who have many concerns, including economic growth and material acquisition and a foundation material for life, but many other concerns as well, and the destruction of that partnership. The assumption that consumers are all you have to be, you don't have to be a citizen anymore, just spend your bucks, vote with your dollars, that is infantile, and that does create a world that none of us really want to live in.
Yeah, Professor Barber, along those lines, many people, Friedman especially, but many others, talk about with the internet, with the free market, that we have more diversity, more choice today, culturally and economically than ever before. I mean, the world is at our fingertips thanks to the internet. Yet you argue, I think in one of the most impressive chapters in the book, that in fact it's the opposite is the case, that we've seen really an end of diversity. It's really quite a striking argument, and it's not entirely original, but I think you put it in a very compelling way. Could you say a few words about that?
Sure, and there are a number of elements to it. One is that multiplying choices, everybody will tell you, including the psychologist, at a certain point has its limits. Give me a choice between three or four things, that's great. Give me 100, and I'm overwhelmed, and it feels like slavery, not choice. And a lot of our choices are infinite brands and so on. But the second and more important point, of course, is the difference between public choice and private choice. You go to L.A., you can drive 200 different brands of cars. Wow, that's a lot of choice. But in fact, what you can't do is take public transportation. That has to be a result of common choices. Those common choices weren't made. There is no effective, viable public transportation. So that private choice is not liberty. Public liberty comes from our ability to determine our public world as citizens, and the real essence of liberty is in public choice. So multiplying private choices doesn't do it. We see that on the airwaves. We've got 500 cable channels, and you run through them, and I don't know, half the time I think there's less diversity on our 500 channels than there are in 5 or 6 channels in France or England, simply because though there are all those different pipes, the content is all coming from exactly the same place.
And when I read that chapter, I recalled the line of the comedian George Carlin who said, in America, you have choice for everything except for the stuff that counts.
Exactly
political
right.
Parties.
That's right. About 10 years ago, there was a company that sold baked potato skins, and it said, we give you liberty. We give you the choice of toppings. And a lot of what Americans think is their vast choices are about the choice of toppings, not the choice of real stuff.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Our guest again on Media Matters today, Ben Barber, author of Consumed, How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole, just published by W.W. Norton. I'm sure it's on the bestseller list. I haven't checked. It better be. We'll be after this show.
if they give you the Imus show, it will be.
Let's go to line 2 now, Chicago. You're on the air with Ben Barber.
Hello. Thank you so much for these issues that you've raised. I'll bet that 90% of the plastic bottles that water comes in don't get recycled. And meanwhile, Coca-Cola has invaded India and is draining their groundwater in a lot of villages for a product that nobody in the world needs. I especially thank you for focusing on the infantilism. There was a film 3 or 4 years ago called The Corporation that featured an interview with a woman in marketing who said, we can't get to the children on TV early enough. We want to start situating them immediately to think of the things they need, the toys they need to pester their parents to buy. Lobbyists in Washington number probably 20,000 on the part of corporations. They know they need government, but they seem to shut out the people and say, oh, you don't have that many choices. There is a group that is trying to reverse the ability of corporations to give money, to lobby, to do anything that resembles what an individual citizen can do. I guess there was a Supreme Court decision on behalf of a railroad in the 1880s that was distorted in the reporting of it, and it has given them that ability. This group, POCLAD, Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy.
No, Colin, we've only got a little bit of time left.
Okay, they're trying to reverse that so that the corporations can only do what they're chartered to do, the way the East India Company did, the way the Hudson's Bay Company did. They answer only to King George.
Okay, well, you know what? I'm going to let Professor Barber take it from here. Thank you so much for calling.
Well, thank you for those great points. And you're right, of course, I think we're probably the country that allows more targeting of younger children than any other country ever in history in the world. I mean, all countries, dictatorships and democracies alike in the past, have tried to some degree protect their children. Whatever we say about giving adults what they want, clearly you can't just give two-year-olds when one-year-olds what they want. Yet today we have a baby-first television channel that is geared to selling things to six-month-old and year-old children. We have psychologists who say that children, toddlers, infants can learn logos before they learn to read, and brand logos saying, great, let's sell them our logo. So this is a very, very serious problem, and conservatives and I think progressives can agree that the targeting of young children by commercial vendors is dangerous, whatever your politics are, and that's something that as citizens and parents, we just have to obstruct and impede.
In fact, one of the things in your book, Professor Barber, that I was most struck by was that for the entire sort of cultural conservative, religious conservative movement, what you're describing is anathema to them. Yet, as you talk about and as Tom Frank's written about, they've generally been supporting policies and politicians that have sort of poured gasoline on this process.
Well, that's right. I'm thrilled to tell you, Bob, that the American Conservative Magazine has just agreed to publish a chapter from my book. So I think there are some conservatives who are beginning to figure out that you can't worry about the nanny state but forget about the nanny corporation. You can't say that the state that disempowers parents from rearing their own children is a terrible thing, but corporations that disempower parents from overseeing the ethics and morals and growing up of their children is okay. And I think there are a lot of conservatives who want to be consistent now. What has surprised me is that I've been on several Christian networks talking about this book, and I think there's a lot of sympathy. So I believe that that kind of hypocrisy that you saw with a big concern among conservatives for the nanny government, but no concern for nanny corporations, that's beginning to change. The people realize that the threats can come from many different places to our children, not just from government.
Yeah, we've only got about a minute left, and I want to get to this one last extraordinarily patient caller. Let's go to line 3 in Champaign. You're on the air with Benjamin Barber.
Yes, I just wanted to talk briefly about this issue of the news role in creating and reinforcing consumer culture. CNN and others are tabloidizing the news. 5 of every 10 headlines is a tabloid point. And I think this has just happened in the past 5 years, and I just wanted to hear your comment on that development and its connection with your thoughts.
And I can say before you get to that, Professor Barber, this is a point you raise in the book, so it's an appropriate question.
It is, and I know we're just about out of time. I think one thing I hope callers know of your own work, Bob, in media reform and paying attention to what has been happening in the media. I mean, most generally, if advertising and marketing corporations are involved in a big way in hyper-consumerism and dumbing down adults and targeting children, obviously the media corporations have a very particular role. And to come full circle back to IMUS, I mean, the fact is they paid IMUS for 30 years as they're paying Stern and they're paying Limbo and so on, not really to do political commentary, not whether they're bigots or not, but to play down to the audience, to make cheap, easy comments, to make listening easy instead of hard, to stop us from growing up rather than helping us grow up. And the media have always been democracy's strongest ally in creating strong and competent citizens. That's why the founders were so concerned with freedom.
You know, that is a perfect ending for our show today, Professor Barber. I want to thank you very much, Benjamin Barber, for joining us today, Media Matters. Ben Barber is the author of Consumed, How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole, just published by W.W. Norton. Again, thank you, Professor Barber.
Thank you so much, Bob, for having me.
I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer. Media Matters will be back in 167 hours. See you then.